is Northfield Outdoors, brought to you by Professional Pride Realty. From hunting to hiking, camping to cooking, mushroom hunting to motorcycling, and so much more, your hosts, Dave Vesladol and Andy Beham, will enlighten, entertain, and inform you with a lively mix of guests and discussion on all things outdoors. And now your hosts, Dave and Andy.
Welcome to another edition of Northfield Outdoors on KYMN 95.1 The One and 1080 AM. Northfield Outdoors is proud to be sponsored by Professional Pride Realty. I'm Dave Vesladol, and of course, along with me is co-host Andy Beham. Well, welcome back, Andy.
Hey, thanks, Dave. How are you doing today?
Good, good. I hear you went on a road trip out to Maine.
Yeah, well, the only road, I guess, was from Boston to Maine. But yeah, we flew into Boston and came in right after a nor'easter, dropped 2 feet of snow on them, and luckily made our way up and... Yeah, played in a hockey tournament up there.
And how did they do?
The girls did awesome. We took second place and unfortunately lost in the championship game in three overtimes, 1-0. So played their hearts out and it was a great time. Stuffed our faces filled with lobster and got to hang out down by the ocean and made it out before the next snowstorm.
Nor'easter. well, that's good. That's good.
How about you? I hear you had a little bit of a... fun doing what you do when it comes to banquets.
Yeah, in a few weeks we're going to be having on Joel Nelson to talk a little bit about turkey hunting. But I had the chance to go to the National Wild Turkey Federation banquet over in Cannon Falls, and I really love that banquet, mainly because usually walk away with something. But this year was perhaps a little embarrassing. I walked out with not only a few bottles of wine and a few other knives and stuff, but also 2 guns this year. So even Joel was giving me a bad time.
I don't know. It kind of sounds like par for course right there.
And I felt really, really bad because the table I was at had several people on it with a lot of raffle tickets and nobody else won a thing. Okay.
You know. Did you go home, crack your wine, and get over feeling bad then?
Yeah, I didn't even have to do that. But again, my hat's off to the National Wild Turkey Federation. They did a really nice job at that banquet.
Yeah, I was wishing that I could have made it over. That's one that you've been talking about for a couple of years that you always have a great time at. And I got to clear my schedule next year for this one. Yeah.
And we'll talk more to Joel about that, about what all they do and stuff.
Yeah. Well, we should have a good show going today.
Yes, but before we get into that, I do have one announcement that I'd like to get out there. And this is about the Bluebird Recovery Program in Minnesota. They're having their annual expo.
Yeah.
You know, last year we had some people on talking about the Bluebird Recovery
program. I'm pretty sure that show is still archived if people want to go out and listen to it.
I would suggest people do that. The expo is going to be on Saturday, April 14th, and registration will start at 8 o'clock. It's going to be in the Cannon Falls High School. I think most everyone can find Cannon Falls will find the high school, but the address is 820 East Minnesota Street on Highway 19. There will be a cost that covers the lunch and some of the or all of the speakers, but it's a day-long session where they're going to have a number of different speakers talking not only about bluebirds, but a number of stuff having to do with climate change. And a lot of good information will be put out there. I mean, we're pretty lucky that there's such a dedicated group to the Bluebird Recovery Program. Without them, we wouldn't have any bluebirds in this state. So just wanted to get that out.
All right.
Well, today we're pretty fortunate to have Steve O'Hearn. Did I say that right, Steve?
Yeah.
He's with his business is Hiawatha Estate Sales. But I met Steve at what was the show? The Midwest Sportsman Show.
Yes, Midwest Sportsman Show at the River Center.
River Center, and got talking to Steve because he had there just a partial of his collection of antique fishing lures and memorabilia and few duck decoys and some of the other stuff. In fact, I've met you at the decoy show also.
Yep. Minnesota Decoy Collectors Association
show. Yeah, we'll have to get in that. That's one I never miss. But Today, Andy, we're going to talk about antique fishing lures. We'll get a little into some of the duck decoys and stuff, but...
You couldn't get this close to the topic and not touch on it.
Exactly. So, but first, Steve, why don't you go ahead and give us a little bit of your background, how you got interested in this, and a little bit about your business.
Well, I started out, believe it or not, at 5 years old. My uncle gave me a Daredevil with no hooks on it.
Okay.
Now, I was an excited little five-year-old boy. Had forgot about that for years, and when I was 17, my brother bought a tackle box from the neighbor, who was a widower, and he bought it for $1.50, and I offered him $2.50, and by God, that was the start of my antique lure collecting.
Why do you think people are interested in collecting old fishing lures?
It's the interest of color collecting.
Okay.
Basically, it excites people to see that, and it's like collecting anything. Once you have a certain amount of them, if you're addicted like I am, you just keep on doing it.
So do you take your personal collection? Do you collect just for yourself to keep, or do you sell some of these antique lures and stuff?
No, I have to sell to support my own habits of collecting of what I like. And like I say, if you start color collecting items, why, then you're getting into some serious money to pay for some of them. The average one, for instance, would be a $10 lure, and then you got five colors. Well, then you find that sixth color you don't have in your collection. Well, a $10 lure can turn into $100, especially if the seller knows you collect them, and et cetera.
Do you, let's talk a little bit about your business. So you help people...
Actually, I do estate sales
for
a living.
Okay.
So I sell just about anything you can find in a house.
Okay.
My next sale is coming up Saturday, today.
Yep.
That's in Bloomington. For instance, I have probably 50 antique reels and some tackle. This gentleman was my good friend collector. Passed away at 98 years old. He also collected toy campers.
Toy campers?
Camper cars and trucks. Oh, okay. With campers on the back, a car.
Boy, that's kind of specializing.
It is, and he has like several hundred of them.
Oh, wow.
And now he has mermaid lures, which was his specialty. He collected mermaid lures, which came out in 1947. Pretty hot items nowadays.
Really?
Matter of fact, they've been better than most of the other name brand lures that come out because there's more novelty collectors nowadays than there was in the past.
Have you seen kind of a growing popularity with the antique fishing lures? Are there more people getting into collecting them?
I would say no.
No? Okay.
There's not more people getting into them. It's like any antique. The younger generation doesn't appreciate what's out there usually.
Yeah.
I try to become best friends with the younger generation who are collecting antique tackle to teach them my knowledge and to keep this going. There's a Minnesota Fishing Museum. I've donated a few things there.
Where is that located?
That's in Little Falls, Minnesota.
Okay.
And that has some of the great history and a lot of Minnesota-made lures in it.
Okay.
People can donate their stuff to that museum. I'm not sure it's all going to get on the floor till they get a new building. But they do a good job of promoting antique fishing lure collector. There's also a National Fishing Lure Collector Club. And I believe there's 3,000 to 5,000 members in it, and they're all in a book, and I'm a member of that since the 80s.
Okay, well, let's start with some real basic information. What makes a fishing lure collectible? What makes it considered to be an antique?
A collectible lure, could just about be any lure.
Okay.
Because Beanie Babies are collectible, were collectible. Okay. Thing of the past. Fishing lures, if you like them and you want to collect them, the best thing to do is just start out with your collection in a shadow box and start building it. If you like a certain lure, go with that brand. As far as vintage, antique, a real antique lure is 100 years old. An antique lure to me is 40 or 50 years old.
Okay.
The collectible ones, they have collectible lures right now that people collect. But they're,
so like limited edition type?
Yeah, Bagley and pre-Rapala Storm, before Ray Ostrom, the owner of Rapala, before he bought that company, Storm made these certain lures, which are Hottentots, they're called. And those pre-Rapala Storm lures and the Bagley lures made in the 70s, 80s, and 90s are good lures, collectible-wise, as far as the younger generation. Some of us veteran collectors think of those things as junk. Well, I don't now because I see what kind of money they bring.
Ah, okay. And do people like to specialize in a type of lure? Like, for example, I'm looking just at collecting spoons.
Okay.
You know, like the daredevils and stuff.
Yep, spoons. Spoons, it would be a metal collector. You would be a metal collector.
So that's what you're referred to as a metal collector.
And then there's five major manufacturers, Hedden, Creek Chub, Pfluger, Shakespeare, and South Bend. Those are the popular brands that
That are still in business right now.
Well,
or not.
No, they're not. They're not the same because what happened is one of the companies bought out 12 companies.
Okay.
So they have the rights to make those lures again. As far as the antique top five lures, they all came out of one area. Most of them were right in this, which we call Plug Alley, from Indiana all the way up into Michigan.
So if I don't want to necessarily specialize in spoons, I could specialize in plugs, or
you could go with wooden plugs made by Hedden. You could go with plastic made by Hedden. You could go Hedden in general, which is basically never ending. You'll never get it all.
Okay.
And the same with Creek Chub and some of the other companies. For instance, miscellaneous lure companies, they make special order colors like Lazy Ike. Well, believe it or not, Lazy Ikes are $2 if you want to buy them from me at a lure show. But if I have a special order one, it runs into the $100.
Are there lures that, how should I say this? There's companies that make certain lures, so I collect from them in the past. But are there certain people that make lures in the from the 30s, 40s, or 50s.
Oh, sure. For instance,
that I would want to go after.
There's a Christensen Frog made in the 30s at 322 Robert Street, St. Paul. Very collectible frog.
And that was a particular
was
person.
A wood frog made by a shoe repair guy. And that makes it really worth a lot of value back when lures were higher, the prices were up. What happened there is all of a sudden 25 of them came out of the woodwork because his niece ended up with his lures he didn't sell after he passed and quit the shoe shop business. But he gave them to some very higher up people like Pillsbury and some of these people that came into it have their shoes repaired.
And he specialized in making a frog.
He made a frog called the Viking Frog, and then he made a smaller one. The Viking Frog came in a cardboard box, had a patent date on the bottom. There were two different models. There's another smaller model of the frog, which now has become more rare than the boxed models, because the box models, somebody found 25 of them at the aunt's garage sale.
And what would something like that go for if a person has one of those and they wanted to sell?
Nowadays, they're about 500 to 600.
Really?
Yes, but in back when...
Andy, check your dad's tackle box.
I know.
Back when lures were higher and before the 25 of those came out, two of them came out of the woodwork, and I happened to have sold those two frogs for a friend who owned them for $7,500.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my
God. So that was probably the most those brought ever. I take that back. One sold for $3,400 plus 15% buyer's commission at a local auction house.
Okay. Are there regional areas? So, for example, do collectors like to, if I'm from the Midwest, like to collect lures that were made in the Midwest? Are there, if I'm out like a Chesapeake Bay, I'm looking just for...
Certainly. Chesapeake Bay, if you find Chesapeake Bay fish decoys, they're that area where they're from, they'll pay more than anyone. There's some La Crosse fish decoys are some of the highest decoys out there, made in La Crosse, Wisconsin, for river fishing. Those are very collectible. There's a new book coming out. So people I know collect Minnesota lures. Other ones collect Missouri. Others collect Michigan. The stuff that we find in Minnesota is worth a lot more in California because we manufactured it here. We find a lot more.
Okay.
Well, I know my family, we've spent a lot of time up in the Hayward, Wisconsin area. And when you get up there, now not only are you selling to people that are into the antique lures, but it's people who want to decorate their cabin with these huge, giant, hand-carved antique musky lures. So does that help drive the price up? Or I shouldn't say help. Does that drive the price up for the people that are just into lures when all of a sudden people want to use them as decoration?
Oh, yes. Because, well, especially discontinued stuff.
Yeah.
Hayward is some of the best musky fishing in the world.
Oh, yeah.
And they have some very famous musky lure makers from Wisconsin, which I consider the best musky lures out there, the Roberts Mud Puppy, one of them right there. They still make them. The Suic bait, that thing catches fish. Not many people know, but Ray Ostrom, who owned Rapala, his favorite lure was a Suic.
Oh.
Because it caught fish.
Yeah.
And so what did that look like? Just a hunk of suet put on a hook?
No, it looks like a piece of broomstick flattened out with the tail on the end, and you pull it on the top. It's a jerk bait. Along the top, and they catch fish. And a friend of mine's a muskie guide for several years, a legend muskie guide on Leech Lake, and he told me that those mud puppies are the best lure around. Well, that's probably why they still make them, because they catch fish.
Yeah.
Do you think that collectors, in some way, as they get to be, I'm going to age myself, I'm a little older than Andy, and we start to look back at the old days of fishing and stuff, and it starts to bring back, so I want to, you remember fishing with your dad, so you want to get some of the lures you
have.
Sure. Does
guys,
that drive some of that?
Oh, a lot of it. Some guys just come around and is all they want is what dad had or what they fished with dad, or they want them for their kids, what they had when they were kids. For instance, that's why... And the generations are different, but that's why the Bagley lures and the Storm lures made in the 70s, 80s are worth so much money, is because a different generation is collecting them. Because now I'm 30 years old, for instance, which I'm not. I'm 59. But that's what makes them collectible, is because those people of that age group are collecting what they had when they were kids, or they caught fish on, etc.
Okay. Well, Steve, we're going to go ahead and we're going to go take a short break to hear from our sponsor.
Professional Pride Realty is a proud sponsor of Northfield Outdoors on 95 The One. Let the staff and realtors at Professional Pride help you make coming indoors from the outdoors a welcoming experience in the home that's right for you. The realtors at Professional Pride are local and know the Northfield market. Whether it's buying your first home, upgrading from your current home, or purchasing your own slice of the outdoors, let Professional Pride help you every step of the way. To learn more, check them out on Facebook or at ProfessionalPrideRealty.com. Keep enjoying the outdoors and let Professional Pride worry about your indoors.
Welcome back. We're talking to Steve O'Hearn with his business is Hiawatha Estate Sales. And Steve is our resident expert here on antique fishing lures, and I've seen him at a number of different shows.
Well, we should also promote luremein.com, his website, if you want to
contact me, luremein.com. It's a website which has my Hiawatha Estate Sales name on the top,
all
but
right.
You can contact me through that and send me pictures and correspond with me and if you have any old lures.
All right.
And you're listening to us on KYMN 95.1 The One and 1080 AM. Steve, we were talking about antique fishing lures, and we talked a little bit about different regions and stuff. Is there a certain time period? You talked a lot about the 70s and 80s, this generation that's kind of buying a lot of them like that. But are there other time periods, like from the teens or from the 20s, that are real popular for people?
Well, I'll tell you, anything pre-1900 is hard to find nowadays.
Okay.
So if you do find it, that is the best stuff, considered by me.
Okay.
And most,
that's our expert.
There we go.
Most people who collect lures, if you find something pre-1925, you're doing good. But pre-1900s, they had a lot of metal-made lures. That's some of the best stuff. I mean, it was the first ones patented. Was in 1852 by a guy who they claimed dropped his spoon in, eating lunch, and a muskie came up or a fish came up and grabbed the spoon. So he decided to take his hook off his other bait and put it on his spoon, and that's how the first the first United States patent came about.
Okay,
that's great.
How do I, as a consumer, I want to start collecting? How do I know that this is a lure that was maybe made in the 70s or 80s or made back in the 20s or made pre-1900.
Well,
are there certain... Help us give us a little information here.
The best source is the internet nowadays.
Okay.
I mean, there's nothing like it. You can take a picture of something and it'll scan it now with eBay and they'll tell you what it is and go by the picture. You don't even have to type in a description. So... the internet's the number one source.
Okay.
If you don't know what your lure is or you want it identified, the best thing is to do is to talk to a collector and say, what do I have here?
I know when I go to like the Minnesota Decoy Show, I always come away learning a lot of stuff. What a wealth of information.
Well, the way to learn is to go to a show.
Yep.
And I mean, or get on the internet and start reading the history. There's chat lines for lures on Facebook. I'm from that older generation, but I have a Facebook under Hiawatha Sales, and I'm a member of a Crazy Crawler, which is a head and lure collector site, a South Bend site, a miscellaneous lure collectors site where you can post stuff and say, hey, what do I have here?
Okay. What... Let's talk a little bit about values. Give us some ranges on what some of these antique lures, and maybe that's a little hard one to say, but say you got some lures from the 70s or 80s, and you get some a little further back, or some from a particular person.
Well, certain ones made by certain people, for instance, and their region, makes a difference to people. The best lure I know of was from Dowagiac, Michigan, and it was a head and lure, and that sold for $101,000. That was a wood lure.
Do you hear everybody going through their dad and grandpa's tackle boxes right now?
No. Now, the best metal lure is definitely a Haskell Minnow, which that's every collector's dream is to find a Haskell Minnow.
And why is that?
Made in 1859, Riley Haskell made guns, and he made a few fishing lures. So as far as metal lures, that was the top lure, and I believe that one sold, I thought, $120,000 plus a little boot, but then the gentleman who bought it, he sold it to somebody else for more money.
Again, I'm hearing a lot of old tackle boxes getting opened up for you
now. Now, does the rarity of it drive it up more, or is, I guess what I'm getting at is a rare manufactured lure worth more than, you know, say a hand-carved, or I guess a hand-carved would be one of a kind, so.
Yeah, there's several, you got to put those into two different categories. You know, there's a folk art, which would be handmade by somebody.
Yep.
For instance, I mentioned those Christensen frogs. Well, he made some other fly rod lures to go with his frogs. And those lures are valuable because they're one of a kind, where the frogs he made a bunch of. If you take a lure from or a Hedden or a Creek Chub or a Shakespeare or a Fluger or a South Bend lure and you have an oddball color, there your value just went up.
Yep.
And it can triple, and that's what makes it collectible, and of course condition.
Okay.
And is condition important?
Condition's very important.
It is, okay.
For instance, you can have Hedden or one of them top five brands or any lure out there that's chewed up is $4 to $50. But if the paint is perfect, it's $200 to $5,000. And that makes a difference on the color of the lure, too. But if it's pristine with the box on any lure, makes it worth double right away.
If I have, I'm just hypothetically talking about a red and white plug wood surface lure that my dad had that he probably fished with in the 50s. And I don't remember the manufacturer, you know, ballpark, what is something like that worth?
Well, it sounds like you got a Bassarino, red and white South Bend Bassarino, but I'm not sure. But that's the most common one that we find out there as far as wood, red and white. I just had 600 of red and white lures. I bought a collection from a gentleman, and he had 600 red and white lures because that's what he collected. Well, a lot of them were that Bassarino. They're about $5 all the way up to $50,000 because
which one
you
do you have
to know which kind of color.
I'll be right back, Andy.
Or which kind of lure, rather, you have. Right, yeah. Right. So if it's a Hedden red and white spearing decoy, it's worth more than a South Bend Bassarino, which is red and white.
Now, you were talking, you just mentioned spearing decoys. That's kind of a whole nother.
It's a whole nother collection.
Yeah.
People who collect lures usually collect spearing decoys, but then there's just people who collect spearing decoys.
Okay.
And spearing decoys are very valuable, especially if you know who made them. The average fish decoy we find is $5 to $10, but every once in a while we'll find that good one. Mm-hmm. And I'll give you an example. I walked in an antique store. They had a antique spearing decoy for $55. I knew it was worth more, so I bought it. But I had no clue that I was going to sell it for $1,600 at the duck show.
So that's why he had such a smile on his face when I walked by.
That's why you, and then, of course, that gave me more money to support my habit of collecting what I collect.
In the end, whatever you make is just going right back in the pool.
Right, but if you've seen my collection, you would realize that. Yeah. He's got some serious money into there, and I have a wife and kids and mortgage, so.
Steve, off the air, you were telling us a little bit about, you have a little bit of a Northfield connection with some reels. that were either made or designed here in Northfield. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. It's called the Whirlaway. And the name came out after the reel was produced in Northfield. And Great Lakes Corporation out of Michigan bought the idea from a gentleman named Clay, who patented that reel.
And he was here in Northfield?
He lived in Northfield. It was Clay Manufacturing Company. And his friend Lind, who lived in Randolph, Minnesota, who eventually moved to Northfield, they became good friends. They made this fishing reel. He made other things. When he moved to Northfield from Randolph, he invented a hatchery cooler for your hatchery.
Oh.
He also invented a spring bumper for your car so you wouldn't smash your car up, and it was water-filled somehow. But he helped.
What year was this reel patented?
This was 52 it was patented in. And okay. Then I correct myself. It was 52 that they started making them. They applied for their patent in 1947. When they got the patent, then Lynn had moved to Northfield. Clay was already manufacturing stuff, so they made this fishing reel. They're marked Northfield, Minnesota. It looks like a softball with a fishing reel handle coming out of it.
And it says Northfield, Minnesota.
It says Northfield, Minnesota right on it, Clay Manufacturing. My friend did some extensive research on it in the 80s. They later sold their idea to the Great Lakes Rod and Reel Company out of Michigan, Great Lakes Products, because the Great Lakes Products rep from Michigan took a trip to Northfield, Minnesota, and wanted to know what they were doing with all these fishing rods.
Oh.
Well, they were sticking them in their Whirlaway rod and reel and selling them, and the Great Lakes Company seen money in front of their eyes, not a quality reel, and bought the item, the patent from Clay, and then started mass producing them. And they're very popular in the 50s, rod and reel, integrated into one.
So the ones with the let's say Northfield, Minnesota on them, those are pretty rare.
Those are some rare items. I found two of them in my 40-plus years of doing this. I have a pile of 10 of them right now, all the models made, the five in Northfield, and then the ones made in Michigan. And I'm trying to get the family of the estate to give them to the Northfield Museum. I've already sent Oberman, whoever.
Kathy
yeah. Oberman.
Osterman. Yep.
Osterman. Pictures of it and waiting for a reply. I know the family will donate them because their father did all the research.
What a neat story.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Now, are these, not that you would actually use them, but are they still like in working condition?
Oh, sure. You can use these, and believe it or not, his thing was to invent a tangle-free rod and reel.
That'd be good for me. I get tangled a lot.
And he did. And he did. He did, basically. And they work good. Cast a country mile, and that's what his product was, is to improve it, where the other company, they seen money in front of their eyes because it's a new gimmick almost. Yeah.
Wow.
Okay. Let's switch it up just a little bit. I know we're getting real close on our time, but I got to get a couple of questions in here about duck decoys.
Here we go. Dave's wheelhouse.
Well, I really love going every year to the decoy show, and I always learn a lot there and stuff. I like the Masons, the Dodge, the Pratt, some of those type of decoys. What is some of your favorites? Is it the manufactured ones or the private carvers that you?
I'll tell you what, my favorite duck decoys are folk art.
Is this a folk art?
Yes. In other words, they're pretty crude looking. Some of them look like duck decoys. Some of them don't. You mentioned earlier when we were off air that you bought an old coot from Bud Grant.
Yes. Okay, you got to share that story, yeah, and I'll finish it off.
And that coot was so cool to me. I had bought that coot a couple years before Bud acquired it at an antique show at the fairgrounds. Well, I was so attracted to that thing, I asked the guy, do you have any more? And he pulled out another one. So I was able to get two of those coots. Just a crude-looking chunk of wood, a log, with a head sticking out of it that looks like a coot painted black.
Yeah, that pretty well describes it.
That's my favorite things, is folk art one of a kind as far as duck decoys. I have a few nicer duck decoys. I love Herder's duck decoys. Believe it or not, they made goose decoys right here in Northfield.
Really?
Yep. And they're cardboard silhouettes, and they came in a cardboard box. I happen to have two packages of six unused in my rafters of my garage. They've been there a few years.
Wow.
But stuff like that is what I like because it's from Northfield, yeah, and it's made in Minnesota, just like that coot was probably made in Minnesota.
So why don't you share, how did it end up that Bud Grant got
there? So Bud Grant comes to the Minnesota Decoy Collector Show, and he went up to a friend of mine, Rick Simpson, and said, what do you want for that, after I had sold him to Rick?
Okay.
And then so Rick sold it to Bud. And then Bud obviously found a sucker when he found you because he sold it to you. So
I went, Andy, I went to his garage sale a couple years ago. Yep. And I'm looking around and not really seeing anything. And I see this coot. It's
out of the corner of your eye.
This decoy. It's a rough, very rough carved one. And I thought, oh, that's kind of cool. And then I got thinking, oh, they actually showed that on WCCO beforehand. So I went and grabbed it and I brought it up to Bud Grant and said, I'm going to buy this, but will you sign it? So he signed it across the back, and then I asked him, could I get a picture of you holding it with you signing it?
And he said, of course.
Of course, for a fee. He charged me another $20 to take the picture. And, of course, I paid it. I mean, it was kind of funny, but I wanted to have the providence that Bud Grant actually signed it. But I must have had a strange look on my face when he said, yeah, for another $20.
I bet.
Okay.
Cheap history.
Yeah. But what a small world, how that made its way around and stuff. The decoy show, when I've gone up there, I've noticed that people are not only buying some of the old, either manufactured ones or from particular old carvers and stuff, but are, looks like there's a growing interest in new carvers coming out with stuff.
There really is, and they're so good. Some of these carvers that come out of the woodwork, you can't believe how good these guys are. Another thing, the wood ones, the cardboard ones that they manufactured, those are becoming very collectible now.
I noticed that at the show, the prices on those are like,
they're still, you know, $10 to $25, but you can't afford a $50,000 Mason duck decoy or a $50,000 other duck decoy. So that's what people are buying, and that's what they're collecting.
I wish I could go back in time and when I had bought some Mason decoys and had bought a lot of those. I wish I could, because what they were going for back in the 70s and what they're going for now is unbelievable.
There's still people who hunt over those.
Yeah.
And that's what's crazy. And, you know, the best goose decoy ever sold was $680,000, and it was made in Osakis, Minnesota. And that's one of the ones that I would like because it was folk art, and the guy made stuff that was crude, but highly collectible.
Well, Mason is still my favorite. I mean, that was the very first
factory early. Yeah.
And it's one of the first ones I bought.
Looks like a duck.
Yeah.
And I've had some pretty good Masons over the years, but I tend to sell them to support my other habit, which is fishing lures.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
All right.
I suppose we're getting close here.
We are.
Any final suggestions back on the antique fishing lures of, well, two questions for you. Talk a little bit more again about if people want to find out more about antique fishing lures, some of the sources, and then finding them, are garage sales and estate sales a good place to go look for antique fishing lures?
Well, definitely garage sales and estate sales are a great place to look. Word of mouth is my best connection over 43 years. People know I collect lures. You let everyone know you collect lures. You hand your card out to every garage sale and estate sale you go to and ask them, if you ever get any lures, will you please call me? I'll make it worth your while. And ads in the paper. I do fantastic with ads in the paper. Okay. So,
I think we just had a decoy flying over here.
Yeah.
I thought I shut my phone off.
No, that's all right. I heard Dave's make noise earlier in the show.
Yes.
But mine quacks.
Yeah.
So. But Steve, do you find, like, at some of the garage sales that, you know, grandpa has passed away, dad has passed away, and their widow or their kids, they really don't know what they have, and they'll put the tackle box out there full of old fishing lures for a couple of bucks?
It's no different than I mentioned that decoy I bought in the antique store. The person probably had $5 into that decoy, said, I'm going to put $55 on it, and I'm going to make $50, and I'm very happy. Obviously, they didn't know what they had. I didn't know what I was buying, but it was worth $1,600 when I figured it out.
So we've been talking with Steve O'Hearn with Hiawatha Estate Sales. And Steve, if someone wants to contact you, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
Best way is to go to luremein.com, which is luremein.com. And there's a email address on there, and you can email me at that address. If you'd like to contact me by phone, my phone number is 952-876-0106, and I live in Bloomington, and I'll travel 1,000 miles for good fishing lures.
Well, I got a feeling with some of the numbers I got thrown away on this show, people might be out in their garage looking at lures right now.
Right now.
Well, I sure hope so.
Yeah.
Any other final suggestions or information you want to pass for the novice collector of fishing lures?
I just want to thank you guys for your time and appreciate it, and I want to promote the hobby. If anybody has any history on something their father or grandfather made or still producing lures, I would love to hear about that. Okay. Because I'm a history buff on it. I like to find out who made it, why, when, and where, and if they caught fish.
Well, hopefully you can get something worked out with the Northfield Historical Society with those fishing reels.
I think so. I've been in contact with them, and they belong in the museum.
Yeah. All right. Well, yeah, this has been a very interesting show, but we are not done yet. We did save just enough time for Dave's interesting facts.
Well,
you're going to try and make me look like a fool. I know.
Well, I have, I think, 6 little interesting facts. Believe it or not, my lovely wife, Jody, got 3 of them correct.
Oh, so you're setting the bar there, so yes, I can definitely fail.
Exactly. And Steve, you join in on this. Okay. These are interesting facts about fishing superstitions.
All right.
Fishing superstitions. So when is it a good time to catch catfish when you hear a certain animal make a noise? So when this certain animal makes a noise, the superstition is, this is a great time to catch catfish.
An owl.
You're kidding.
I'm not kidding.
You got that one right.
Yes.
I was going to say an owl.
Okay.
I'm a catfish.
This is a little too easy.
Trying to think of any other animal that would mean anything at all.
Well, good.
It means it's nighttime. Okay.
You guys are one for one. If a person does this in the boat while they're fishing, they won't catch a fish.
Steve, go ahead.
This is a old superstition. If a person does this in a boat, they're not going to catch a fish.
I'm going with sneeze.
And you are incorrect.
There we go. Now we're back on track.
What do you think, Steve?
Sing.
You are incorrect also. The old superstition is, if you swear, you're not going to catch a fish. Odds are that was started by a mom someplace with her kids.
Never went fishing with my dad.
Yeah, right.
okay, if you do this in a boat, it's going to bring you bad luck. Not only not catching a fish, but just really bad luck in your boat if you do this.
If you spill your beer.
You are incorrect.
I know I am. I have nothing on this one.
I'm blank.
If you cut your hair or trim your nails.
I don't know the last time I thought about cutting my hair on a boat, Dave.
Well, that's an old fishing superstition. If this animal is seen near your fishing tackle before you go out, you're going to have bad luck.
Dog.
Steve is correct.
I was going to say dog.
Oh, sure you were. This particular fruit you do not want to bring on your boat when you're going fishing, because it could not only mean you have bad luck fishing, but it could spell a disaster for your boat.
Banana.
Steve, okay.
Steve is actually going to say banana.
Oh. Yeah.
Because there's one turning brown on my cutting board at home right now. I'm like, oh, that could be bad.
Okay, you guys are really good. You guys are really good. Okay, last one here. If you bring a fishing pole where before you put it on your boat, you're not going to catch any fish.
To the supermarket.
I'm wrong.
You're wrong.
To the fish market.
No, if you bring your fishing pole into the house before you go fishing, you're not going to catch a fish.
Huh.
So those are our fishing superstitions of the day.
So there we go.
Hey, you guys did really
smarter
good.
Smarter than your wife? Or
yes.
Well, I don't know.
I think together we're almost even.
Oh, I got to commend you guys on that. You did very well.
All right. Well, thanks again to Steve O'Hearn with Hiawatha Estate Sales for being with us today and educating all of us on antique fishing lures and collection. As always, tune in next week to On Tap with Corey and Ira to learn everything about beer in southern Minnesota. The show will be archived on KYMNradio.net and found under Northfield Outdoors. And thank you to Hayes for updating the Northfield Outdoors Facebook page and to Professional Pride Realty for sponsoring the show. And as always, Dave.
So until next time, get out there and enjoy the outdoors. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Steve.
Thanks.
This has been Northfield Outdoors with Dave Vesladol and Andy Behem, brought to you by Professional Pride Realty. Join Dave and Andy every other Saturday morning at 11 o'clock right here on 95 The One or streaming at kymnradio.net.